This is WS2N.
5-1 Luna Wild, Puma's in the building. Tazzy, Will's in the building. The homie.
It was a longer transmission pull.
Thank you.
has his antenna on target.
I'm hearing him on the 975-375 machine. He's coming through that machine very well, but unfortunately it's being blocked to this machine. At this time, we're not going to be able to make it, Paul. And so, maybe later on tonight, when those mobile guys are no longer as enthusiastic, maybe we'll be able to do it at that time. And I know that you don't have to go to work tomorrow morning, so hopefully we can do that. Glenn, if you're there, KCQQIQ, according to John, one of the things I should discuss is the basketball in the pond, if you know what I mean. KC2QIQ, K2RIW, is there, Glenn?
Yeah, good evening, Dick. I'm here. I just don't know if I'm making it over the noise.
You're doing beautifully at this time. Assume now that I've got a 1 mile diameter round lake, nice calm water lake, and I've got this magic suspension bridge that goes over the lake that doesn't have any columns penetrating the lake. It's only connected to the two shores a mile apart. And I'm leaning over the side of this suspension bridge, and I've got this basketball in my hand. And just to give you an example of what I'm talking about, let me first talk about a spring hanging from the ceiling with a weight at the bottom of that spring. And it's sitting there in rest. I walk over to the spring, and I apply some energy to it. I pull down on the weight, which is stretching the spring, and I've put energy into that system. I'm applying a force through a distance. I'm stretching the spring. After doing that, I let go, and now the weight bounces up and down on the spring. And what's happening now is that at the time I let it go when I was pulling on it, I've poured some stored potential energy into the spring, which became kinetic energy of motion of the weight, and the weight is now swinging back and forth in a sine wave manner. If there was no wind resistance and it was a high enough efficiency spring, in theory it would swing forever. With the kinetic energy and the potential energy swinging back and forth between the weight and the spring. Let me drop. Okay, so that's an oscillating system. I'm now back to that basketball. I'm leaning over the side of the bridge, and I'm pressing the basketball down into the water. And I'm doing this in a cyclic manner. I'm pushing the basketball down, and I'm pulling it back up in, let's say, 1 second intervals. And I'm now creating these circular waves being radiated out from the basketball. And if I, at the perimeter of the lake, if I've got... At the perimeter of the lake, I've got sensing devices. And for me to detect those waves that I've created with the basketball at the perimeter of the lake would be pretty easy to do. And if I wanted to, in theory, I could put a zillion detectors around the whole perimeter of the lake and collect essentially all of that energy. I would find out that a high percentage of the energy that I'm creating by pushing and letting up on this basketball in the lake, I'm creating these circular waves, and I could recover a good significant percentage of that energy if I'm willing to put enough sensors around the perimeter of that lake. In other words, the energy I'm putting into those waves get propagated through the surface of the water, and they appear out at the perimeter. They fall off at a very predictable inverse square law, so to speak. It's probably an inverse linear law because it's a one-dimensional system. It's a kind of a radial transmission line. But do you see what I'm talking about? At first, when it comes to cyclic waves of water created by a basketball that I'm pushing up and down into that lake. Does that make some sense so far, Glenn? KC2QIQ, K2RIW.
Yes, Dick, you've just invented the K2RIW wave pool. Go ahead.
So in my example, I've got a lake that's approximately 1 mile in diameter. It's circular, and I've got this basketball that I'm pushing up and down. I'm making these waves, and detecting them half a mile away would be pretty easy with a good wave detector, assuming I don't have a lot of wind blowing on the lake. And I could easily change the frequency. In other words, I could push the ball down, let it back up, and then wait 4 seconds before I push it down and let it back up again. I could make these individual waves have approximately the same amount of energy per wave, but I could change the frequency by making the dead spaces between the waves anything I like. I could easily do that. That's experiment number one. Here's experiment number two. now push the basketball into the lake extremely slowly. I'm not making a wave. I'm pushing the basketball into the lake extremely slowly and holding it there. That's a steady state equivalent. That's the equivalent of a bomb magnet sitting on the table, and a half a mile away you want to detect that magnetic field. I push the basketball down into the lake. I've made a steady state kind of a wave, but I've done it so slowly that I didn't make a wave, and I hold it there. What I've really done is the basketball itself is, let me say, oh, it's got a half cubic foot of volume. When I pushed it down, I've displaced half a cubic feet of water. But because I didn't create a wave, what I've done is I've raised the level of the whole lake, a mile diameter of water. I've added an extra half a cubic foot of water, so to speak, by pushing the basketball down very slow. The actual amount of rise of all of that water in the lake is maybe only a couple of molecules thick. And now, half a mile away at the perimeter of that lake, you try to detect the fact that I did that a half hour ago. With a little bit of wind that's blowing and other waves and whatever on the lake, the chances of you...
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
I'm saying the chances of you detecting that are very slim. So a steady state bar magnet, magnetic field, viewed from one end, half a mile away, no matter what kind of magnetic detector you and I use, I think it's almost impossible to reliably detect that. Very similar to me pushing the basketball very slowly down in the lake once, displacing half a cubic foot of water compared to the millions of gallons of water that's in that lake, and you try to detect it at the end, you probably couldn't do it. So detecting cyclic waves in a lake, detecting cyclic magnetic field coming out of an antenna a mile away is easy. A steady state magnetic field from a bar magnet, even if the bar magnet is during this half hour the north end is aimed toward you, during the next half hour the south end is aimed toward you, and you sit a mile away and try to detect that, I don't think you can do it. I push that basketball into the lake, and I hold it down there for the first half hour, and you try to detect that I've done that, and during the next half hour, I very slowly retract it from the lake, and I've changed the height of the lake by a couple of miles of height, and you try to detect that, you can't do it. So there's part of my understanding the degree of difficulty of trying to detect a cyclic magnetic field or a cyclic wave motion in that lake versus a steady state. Does that make some sense so far, Glenn? KC2QIQ, K2LIW.
Yeah, very good, Dick. Basically what you're bringing up is, what is the difference between average volume, peak-to-peak kinetic energy, and the measurement capabilities of both. It's true, when you push the ball very, very slowly to the bottom of the lake, you're going to get a rise, which would just be the average value of increase at the extremities of the lake, which is not very, very easy to do. But by adding more kinetic energy, by moving that ball up and down through the water, now you have a peak value, an average value, and an RMS value to that. And you have a continuous wave, so it means that you have, depending on the period, you can look cycle to cycle for that difference, as opposed to a very, very long period of time of just a one, average level increase. So absolutely, the continuous wave is always going to be much easier to detect in that application than the continuous wave will always be much easier to detect than just the average value over a long period of time. Back to you, Dick. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
And there's even a little bit something more going on here. In the case of the basketball that I'm pushing cyclically, each individual push down and pull back up, I'm putting a certain number of joules of energy into the way I'm pushing that basketball. I'm applying a force through a distance as I push it down into the lake and pull it back up. And those waves that spread out, each of the individual circular waves that spread out, contain a high percentage of the energy that I put into it. So the nice thing about about those cyclic waves is that each individual wave contains the number of joules of energy that I pushed into the basketball during that particular cycle. And most of that energy... And most of that energy is coupled into that wave. And the wave, when it approaches the detector at the shore, the leading edge of the wave versus the tail edge of that individual wave, maybe that wave is only, a foot in depth, so to speak, toward the center of the lake, that contains most of the energy, if I take the whole darn circle, of what I did when I pushed the basketball in. However, the steady state situation, when I very slowly pushed the basketball into the lake and held it, it's now not a wave going to the perimeter of the lake that has 1 foot of leading edge versus trailing edge, where all the energy is in that 1 foot of leading edge to trailing edge depth of the wave. It's now a steady state condition where the whole mile diameter of lake, I tried to raise the level of all of that water. The so-called steady state wave is now not a ring of water with all the energy into it spreading out to the lake, out to the perimeter of the lake. It is, by comparison, the whole Don Lake being raised one molecule in height across its whole 1.5 square miles of area, if you know what I mean. So that gives you a little bit of a feeling for why measuring a steady state magnetic field is extremely difficult at a long distance, no matter what the sensitivity of your detector is, whereas a cyclic magnetic field, where each individual wave contains that number of joules of energy that I have issued when I made that cyclic wave. Not only is it a nice bundle of energy coming toward you when it's the cyclic wave, not only nicely focused, but measuring the peak to valley, as you are mentioning, you automatically reset the system on each individual cycle, whereas to try to find out where is the datum point and the change in a steady state raise of water in the lake is a very difficult thing to do in the real world, because in the real world there's wind blowing across that lake and there's a hell of a lot of other random motions going on that are going to dominate. So far, does that make some sense, Glenn? KC2QIQ, K2LIW.
Yeah, absolutely, Dick. What you've eloquently described is the magic of the root mean square and the advantage of it on within a period and wavelength that, you know, when you create that change of kinetic energy, each cycle actually contains that percentage at the ratio of the inverse square to each wave as it travels over distance. So it's a very, very powerful, analysis that measuring a continuous wave as opposed to steady state is always going to be much more advantageous.
Now, there's another thing that you've said quite often that I want to bring to your attention, and that is a Hall effect device, the actual little chip called Hall effect, the indicator itself, not all the stuff you put around it. One of the things that's being sold by DigiKey is an ordinary $3 Hall effect device, which has a claimed sensitivity of 160 microvolts per douse. You give it one douse of magnetic field, and it produces 160 microvolts of differential signal between its 9 o'clock and 3 o'clock position. I remember when I first had a douse meter in my hand way back in the early 70s. At that time, I measured the steady-state Earth's magnetic field, and at that time, it was 450 milligauss, so 0.45 douse, as opposed to 160 microvolts per gauss, means I guess I would have gotten something in the vicinity of 60 microvolts of signal out of that particular inexpensive Hall effect device. And it was a cheap one. It's not necessarily the most sensitive one. So from my point of view, you felt that a Hall effect device is very insensitive. From my point of view, the magnitude of the Earth's magnetic field is relatively small, and if that detector can so easily detect it, then I would call that a low-sensitivity device, and depending how you feel about that, I'm about to add to that. So let me turn it back to you first, Douglas. KC2QIQ, K2LIW.
Yeah, what's interesting is that when you look at low frequency properties in DC properties, gain is very easy to achieve. Obviously as an example, you could take a voltmeter and detect very small microvolts pretty easily. But you know yourself, when you start increasing the frequency, the bandwidth falls off pretty rapidly. With magnetic devices, that happens like tenfold. When you take any kind of like these sensors and you look at their sensitivity at very close to steady states and very low frequencies, frequencies under 100 hertz, you get very good sensitivity. As the frequency goes up, it becomes a lot more of a challenge.
The Analog Devices Company, among others, is making some very high performance, and so is Texas Instruments, making very high performance operational amplifiers. Some of them have gain bandwidth products that go well into the gigahertz region. So some of them are completely flat in response, so to speak. If I'm using it as a linear, as a unity feedback operational amplifier, they can be very flat in response out to 100 megahertz. So if I'm using one of those, fairly low noise, fairly high frequency, analog devices, operational amplifier, and some of them go down to numbers like 1.2 nanovolts per root hertz. So they're pretty low in noise, pretty high in sensitivity, pretty high in gain, and pretty high in frequency response, and only a couple of bucks. So modern day op amps have come a long way. Assuming now that I can find some ferrite, like the ferrite loop strip that's in my AM transistor radio, and if I take that rod and I put the rod right down the middle, and I now put the right-hand side of that rod against the lower surface of the Hall effect device, and the other half of the rod against the upper surface of the Hall effect device. So now the ferrite rod is a magnetic concentrator. Whatever is going on in the free space world, the magnetic field will gather itself toward that ferrite rod, because the ferrite rod has got a permeability that's a hell of a lot higher than the surrounding air. Let me drop. So by putting that ferrite rod broken into two pieces up against the ferrite device, and assuming the little chip inside the ferrite device is, let me pick a number, a 32nd of an inch thick of semiconductor material, and I've got my ferrite rod touching the lower flat surface of that semiconductor material, the other half the upper surface, so now my magnetic concentrator of my ferrite rod is concentrating the magnetic field flowing through the chip of the Hall effect device. I think I can now make its sensitivity of amps per meter of magnetic field versus microvolts that I get out of the Hall effect device. I think I can increase it quite a bit. In fact, there are websites that show you pictures of that exact thing being done. So far, does that make some sense, Glenn? KCQ, QIQ, K2LIW.
Yeah, it does, and I know where you're going with this, but where the problem you're going to run into here, Dick, is that you have to close the magnetic field path. And that's where everything becomes ambiguous again, but I'm going to let you continue, and then I'll explain a little bit more about that later. KC2QIQ.
If that transmitter that's issuing that, let me pick a number, 1 megahertz radio wave being picked up by that ferrite rod, if that radio was 1 mile away from me, the curvature of those magnetic field lines that get into my environment are essentially flat. Those magnetic field lines do close. They are closed loops, but that closure of the transmitted wave magnetic field, from my point of view, takes place way out there at infinity. The local magnetic field in amps per meter that you and I can measure in a laboratory, and I'm now increasing the sensitivity of the way I make that measurement in this laboratory by having this ferrite rod parallel to those magnetic field lines, and the ferrite rod itself, it does not close. The field that's emitted by that transmitter a mile away from me, yes, it does close, but way out there in free space. I don't care about that. I can still concentrate what locally comes to me, and I can measure what locally comes to me. Am I violating any physics when I do that? I know for a fact that Hall effect device, when it's measuring the Earth's magnetic field, which happens to close on a path that's a, the Earth's circumference is 25,000 miles. The circumference of the Earth is 25,000 miles. The magnetic fields, the lines coming out of the Earth, are closing in a path that's got 25 miles of diameter to it, 25,000 miles of circumference to it. But that Hall effect device, no trouble measuring the magnetic field that's in my particular laboratory, because those magnetic field lines, assuming there's no local deal in my lab, those magnetic field lines are nice and linear in my lab. The Hall effect device measures them. I've done that. Yes, they have to close, but they close way out in infinity, 12,000 miles away from me. Therefore, I don't care about that. And the Hall effect device in my hand is a simple probe on the end of a handpiece, and it has no need for closing the magnetic field in order to measure 160 microvolts per gauss. Where's the problem? KC2QIQ, K2LIW?
The problem, Dick, is that the strongest electromagnetic field that's going to be in your environment is going to be 60 cycle. The Earth's magnetic field is really, really lightweight. And what you'll find out is that the bandwidth of that device is so narrow, it's fractions of Earth's. Then you've got tremendous gain down there, and that allows you to do it. Because if it wasn't, and you were anywhere near a power line, a boom with a light bulb lit, or anything, just the magnetic field path of a light bulb running at 60 cycles would just blow that thing way off scale. So I think you probably understand what I mean about bandwidth now and the ratio of in decibels per decade at what that roll-off is. It's pretty sharp.
I wish I remember the brand name of the Gauss meter that I had in my hand in 1972. A commercially made Grep device, nothing really fancy. I think we paid a couple $100 for it, maybe $1,000. And I do remember it had an AC coupling out the back panel where, yes, I could put it near a 60-cycle transformer and I could measure the magnetic field, the 60-cycle component. I then put it near a 400-hertz transformer running at 400 hertz. I measured its magnetic field. So to the nearest 0 to 5 kilohertz, it was broadband, gave me a beautiful indication of what was nearby. 60 cycles, steady state, 400 hertz, no problem. So I did that. That's what I saw. I connected an oscilloscope to that AC coupling out the back panel, and that Hall effect device and that simple handpiece was measuring that magnetic field. I didn't have to put a super narrow band filter on it. I will admit that when I'm trying to measure something way up there at 1 megahertz, assuming the Hall effect device has got reasonable performance at 1 megahertz.
What manufacturer was it? Was it RFL?
Don't remember the manufacturer. Could have been. But what I'm getting at is way up at 1 megahertz. Probably I would need a 1 megahertz bandpass filter to reject all of those other noises, because I'll admit that the magnitude of the magnetic field I'm going to get at 1 megahertz from a broadcast transmitter a mile away, even with a ferrite loop concentrator, is going to be quite small compared to the local 60-cycle, 400 hertz, or whatever. I'm going to agree with you with that. By the way, when you look at magnetic concentrators, when you look at ferrite rods, and in fact, I was looking at what I needed to know is the formula for measuring the volume of a pyramid. And while I'm looking at all of these beautiful pictures on that particular website, right under the Wikipedia response from Google, some of the pyramids they were talking about were pyramid-shaped chunks of ferrite put on the left side and the right side of a Hall effect device to act as magnetic concentrators. If now that ferrite rod was in the form of two pyramids where the sharp point of the pyramid is touching the Hall effect device, I can get a lot more concentration of magnetic field. And so tuning it to 1 megahertz, I believe that that Hall effect device could easily measure the transmitted magnetic field at 1 megahertz. I haven't done it, but I see reason why I could be able to do it. Am I violating any physics here, Glenn? KC2QIQ, K2LIW.
Okay, let's take a step back. First, you're using a device that you're measuring the Earth's magnetic field with, and you came up with a number. And it's pretty small, isn't it? Now, when you go next to a transformer, the field that's around a transformer, 60 cycle or 400 hertz transformer, is immense compared to the world's magnetic field, and it's cyclical. And you have to be so close to it in order to measure 60 and 100 hertz or 400 hertz. Your proximity was ridiculously close. That in itself should give you an idea of the sensitivity problem as you're going up in frequency. That when you use that device near a 60 cycle transformer, you had to be close to it to measure it. In other words, when you're measuring the Earth's magnetic field with that same device, you're just out in the wilderness, for heaven's sakes, or anywhere, and it'll detect it because the gain there is huge at very, very low frequency. As you're going up, what you're going to do is you're basically increasing the gain with an amplifier. But there are other tricks. In other words, you have to close the magnetic path. Once you close the magnetic path length around with either ferrite or magnets and you close it, now you can intensify the field around the Hall effect device and get extremely accurate current measurements and then use your amplifier to recorrect the gain. That's a very common practice for use of these types of devices when you're measuring DC current at high, in other words, like an AC signal, but superimposed on a DC bias with such a device. That's very, very common. But it's not easy without a closed magnetic path to be able to do that, Vic. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
To this Gauss meter, when I measured the Earth's magnetic field and twisted the Gauss meter in various angles to look for the null, I don't know the exact number, but I think it was able to measure Earth's magnetic field 40 decibels above threshold. I could tune for the null by changing the orientation of the handpiece, the Gauss meter at the end of the handpiece, and I could get 30 or 40 decibels of null. It had more than enough sensitivity to do that. And the magnetic field I was measuring was a 400-cycle/60-cycle transformer inside of a spectrum analyzer. The transformer was inside of a mu metal shield. We were doing that because our voltage-controlled oscillator that we had to use on that spectrum analyzer was a fairly broadband, high-frequency responding voltage-controlled oscillator that did the sweeping in the narrow scan width areas of the spectrum analyzer. When the spectrum analyzer went down to 1 megahertz per centimeter and lower, we went over to a voltage-controlled oscillator that was free-running. Local magnetic fields would superimpose a 60-cycle or 400-cycle waveform on top of that VCO, and it gave us grief. So we put the transformer in a mu metal shield. It helped a whole lot. Depending on the quality of the mu metal the guy was buying that particular month, depending on how well he sealed the corners, I'm now holding this Hall effect device multiple inches, probably as much as 6 inches away from the mu metal can with the transformer inside. The transformer itself, by the way, was a cube, a 4-inch cube, if you know what I mean. Had a whole lot of voltage windings, and it's running 300 watts of power. I could easily detect that 400-cycle or 60-cycle field multiple inches away on the far side of a mu metal shield. So detecting 400 hertz, I don't know the exact...
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
I don't know the exact number, but I believe if I had to detect a few milligauss with that meter at 60-cycle or 400 hertz rate, I believe it could do it, Glenn. KC2QIQ, K2RIW.
Okay, I'm gonna run this one by you, and I'm gonna ask you to put your thinking cap back on here and rethink this one. When you're back and you're measuring the Earth's magnetic field, and you got a number, and then you brought that meter within inches of a 60 cycle or a 400 cycle transformer around new metal or whatever, you got another number. And I bet you those two numbers, where the 400 cycle transformer, when you were close or nearby to it, was pretty darn big, a lot bigger than what you were measuring with respect to the Earth's magnetic field. Now, as you started moving that sensor away from that transformer in inches, was it falling off at inverse square law or something much steeper? KC2, QIQ.
I'm not sure, but I think it was falling off by a cube law. It fell off pretty fast. But I could measure the magnetic field outside of a new metal can with the probe held probably 6 inches away from the mu metal can. I was literally measuring the quality of the mu metal enclosure of the can that was trying to lower the magnetic field that was giving us grief on our circuitry. And 90-some-odd% of the time, that was successful. Every so often, though, the manufacturer would either buy a cheap lot of the EI laminations that he made the transformer out of, and therefore the transformer was saturating, particularly when they went down to 50 hertz, and or he wasn't doing a good enough job on the mu metal can. So if either of those degraded, the quality of the EI laminations or the quality with which he sealed the mu metal can, then we got external magnetic field that gave us grief. But I believe that that Hall effect device was measuring a few milligauss. I noticed that the Earth's magnetic field at roughly 450 milligauss was a huge signal that I had no trouble detecting. And that was a simple Hall effect device on the end of a handpiece with no magnetic amplifier of any kind connected to it. It didn't have any ferrite rods or whatever. It looked like just a raw Hall effect device sitting on the end of a handpiece. And the end of that handpiece, as I remember, it was about a quarter inch or a third of an inch square, if you know what I mean. Over to you, Glenn. KQLIW.
Yeah, see, now you're starting to come in line with what I'm saying here, is that there's an issue with between E-field and H-field, that when you're measuring H-field, you're going to fall off that cube law. When you're following E-field, you're going to fall off at inverse square. So that's a big problem for H-field measurement. The amplitudes are not direct. Now, when you measure with an E-field sensor, you'll always reestablish the H-field back in phase because of resonance in the antenna. It's a very interesting concept that isn't pointed out in a lot of electronics books, but when you're doing that, it's always something that you can always see the difference with a Hall effect sensor as opposed to the other. There is a way of correcting it, though, and that's how if you close the electrical field path of the magnetic field sensor with ferrite and magnets, you can recreate it and reestablish that relationship again so that your H field and your E field, basically what you're doing is you're building like an antenna structure is really what's happening. Let me see if you're following me so far, Dick, and maybe I might have to explain that again. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
When I'm measuring the magnetic field coming out of a transformer, I'm inside of the reactive near field of that transformer if I'm using antenna terminology. However, if I look at the C95 report of the, it's now called the American National Standards, American National Standards, ANCI C95 report, which defines the amount of power flux density, milliwatts per square centimeter, and whatever, that a human being is allowed to be exposed to. You look at that report, they measure the E field of an RF free space wave. Assume now I'm in the far field, where the wave is thoroughly planar. They measure the E field in volts per meter. They measure the H field in amps per meter. Those are the units being used. As you read through that report, you rapidly come to the conclusion that when I double the distance between me and the transmitter, and I'm in the far field of that transmitter's antenna, I double the distance, I get half the number of volts per meter of E field, I get half the number of amps per meter of H field. According to that report, on a far field RF wave, they both fall off in a thoroughly linear manner. Yes, near a transformer, you get this cube law because you're in the reactive near field of the transformer. But an RF wave in free space behaves by a linear law according to that document, which has been around for 60 years, and it's got 450 references, and it's traceable to the Bureau of Standards. What's wrong there, Glenn? KCQQIQ, K2RIW?
There's nothing wrong with the measurement, Dick, and it's right on the money. It's just understanding what the measurement means. In other words, when you're looking at an antenna in a cross-section, that is going to have a cross-section to an electromagnetic wave from. When you divide it into a, divide the E-field across, through that cross-section, you're going to have an E-field measurement. The antenna is going to have a proportion because there's a direct relationship with the antenna's length and its impedance to B over H. So the established B over H will always be in direct proportion to E and H. So that's just the proportion of the antenna. Are you following me on that so far?
Yes, I am. And when you and I at HF frequencies made that measurement in the laboratory, frequently we used that cage dipole-like thing. We adjusted its physical length to be resonant at the frequency we cared about, and we made the measurement. We used that particular piece of instrumentation because it was the established standard. However, you and I, if we wanted to, can by way of the fiber optics thing with the polonium sources we discovered in the past, I believe I could thoroughly, separately measure the E-field by way of Hall effect devices with or without magnetic concentrators. I could independently measure the amps per meter of H-field if I wanted to. Yes, it's the less frequently used technique, not traceable to the Bureau, but you and I could come up with a technique to thoroughly independently measure E, thoroughly independently measure H. Am I optimistic with those thoughts, Glenn? KCQQIQ, K2LIW?
Well, if you follow Hube law and you get close enough to your radiating objects, I agree that you could probably come to something, you know, with like 200 dB ignition, you can probably measure something. Would you start getting miles away? I highly doubt it. Because, you know, cube is a much harder relationship to deal with than square. So without resonance and without electronic reestablishment or resquaring, the cross-section of an E-field sensor, I don't think it's going to be that easy to do. Now, as I said, there are correction factors. When you take a Hall effect device and you close the magnetic path, now, how do you do that? Let's say if you took a quarter wavelength of ferrite on one side of a Hall effect device and put a quarter wavelength on the other side. Now, basically, you have a ferrite rod that's at quarter wave on each side. But now, the thing is, you're going to hold that out in the field and try to sense anything, and you're going to get buckus. I don't care whether you put a 200 dB gain antenna at the frequency you want to sense. Unless you're so close to it, you're not going to measure a darn thing. But now, you want to create some magic. What you want to do is take a piece of steel iron or magnet path and short circuit the outside of those two rods. So now you've shorted the magnetic path, and all of a sudden the signal will come back up. But which raises the question again: are you measuring E field at that point again through the piece of steel that's shorted around the outside of the rod, or are you really measuring H field? It's like kind of like the cat chasing its tail, Vic. K2IW, KC2QIQ.
You keep talking about the H field falling off by a cube law. When you and I are making a measurement in the reactive near field of a transformer, or if in the laboratory you and I are testing a handheld device and the external magnetic field at radio frequencies being radiated must be measured, again we're in the reactive near field, it falls off as a cube law. However, if you look at the final chart, the bottom line chart, it's a horizontal display of frequency, a vertical display of the parameter to be measured when it comes to radio frequency biohazard out of the C95 report. You'll find that from 10 megacycles and above, almost everything is rated in milliwatts per square centimeter. That must not be exceeded. And there is a controlled and uncontrolled environment. There are two separate curves. However, below 10 megacycles, below 1 megacycle, I'm not quite sure where the transition is, you no longer have a simple measurement of milliwatts per square centimeter. You now must fulfill three separate criteria. One is milliwatts per square centimeter. One is volts per meter. One is amps per meter. There are three separate criteria. Below, let me pick a number, 1 megacycle, according to the C95 report, that you will make three separate measurements and make sure you do not exceed any of the three. The reason for that, let me drop, is that the human body behaves in a peculiar way, which I call through you, in you, off you. At the low frequencies, most of the RF energy goes right through you with very little effect. At the intermediate VHF frequencies, almost all of it gets absorbed and turned into heat, between 30 and 300 megacycles. Above 300 megacycles, most of the energy starts reflecting off your skin. It reflects off of you, through you, in you, off you. That's the off you region. Okay, in the low frequency region, below 30 megacycles, the curves of allowable power flux density climb at 60 B per octave and go up to a maximum number. But those maximum numbers in milliwatts per square centimeter, I think it goes up to about 100. I forget what the volts per meter. The volts per meter used to be 190 volts per meter, and I forget what the amps per number per meter are. But at frequencies below approximately 1 megacycle, there are 3 separate criteria which will be independently measured, and you will confirm them in order to fulfill the requirements for radio frequency biohazard. That strongly implies that E field can be measured, H field can be measured, and milliwatts per square centimeter can be measured, and that the E and the H in a far field RF wave fall off in a linear manner and are measurable. That's what that report is saying for the last 60 years. KC2QIQ, K2RIW.
And I'm completely agreeing with the report. The report is correct. But what you have to understand is that along with that whole report, okay, there's a whole other section that tells you how to make the measurements that goes along with it and describes what the measurement is. I think where the confusion factor is coming in is that the point of misunderstanding is, what is the measurement? In other words, are you measuring real H field, or are you measuring the H field with respect to the E field in cross-section? There are two different measurements. In other words, what you're thinking of is there's a three-dimensional measurement. In other words, what is happening to the rings of magnetic flux leaving a transmission source in free space? Then you're going to take, at some point in a far field, an antenna, and you're going to create a cross-sectional cut. And when you're going to measure it, you're going to measure it with a device that's going to have some normalized impedance, a matching network, an antenna. And when you're measuring with an antenna, B and H are always going to have a fixed relationship in that antenna. But that fixed relationship inside the antenna is not the same relationship as the E and H relationship in free space. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
Okay. The fact that 3 separate measurements at low frequencies will be measured strongly tells me that I can independently measure E, I can independently measure H. We haven't yet described what instrumentation is used. So let me ask you a direct question, Glenn. Can I independently measure the H field in units of amps per meter? Can I come up with instrumentation, like a Hall effect device, that independently measures amps per meter of H field in order to separately fulfill that particular requirement of the C95 report on radio frequency biohazard? KC2QIQ, K2LIW.
Of course you can, and you pass by a mile. And the reason why you pass by a mile is because the measurement you're going to get is going to be in the mud by comparison to what those graphs are normalized to antennas. But if you were to take an H-field detector, a true H-field detector, and you could prove to everyone else that that's what you're doing, and you can definitely do it, and within certain frequencies and certain, you know, limitations of what you can get away with in a Hall effect device at low enough frequency, you could probably do it, and you could be well within that standard, because the relationship of B to H in an aerial cross-section is going to always be far, far less than, the aerial cross-section is in an antenna is always going to be far higher than it's going to be in an actual H-field measurement in the true rings coming directly from a radiating source. K2IW, KC2QIQ.
Okay, you were implying with that last transmission, transition of yours, Glenn, that the E and the H bear a certain relationship inside of my sensing antenna. I say no. The E and the H are a truly free space wave. When I'm in the far field of the emitting device, the E and the H have a relationship to each other because of Mother Nature's 377 ohms of free space. The relationship between E and H is dictated by 377 ohms, not dictated by the antenna I use for the sensing. As such, I can use instrumentation that thoroughly independently measures E. I can use instrumentation that thoroughly measures H. If I did it with an antenna with calibration factor, it's one way. That's the usual way it's done. But I can do it with other instrumentation that measures H and doesn't respond to E. You keep saying, no, I can't do that. The fact that there are three separate curves say that they are asking you to do that. KC2QIQ, K2LIW.
Well, first off, I didn't say that. I said you can measure it, okay? But the problem is it's going to be a very, very low number. What I'm saying is that the E to H in an area cross-section is going to be the worst-case value of H. In free space, the H value is going to be falling off at a different ratio than the E field. But with the antenna, it's a kind of like a correction factor. But because of HF, VHF, UHF, an antenna is used, they use the cross-section value of what the antenna recreates H at in resonance. So that's going to have a proportion in the antenna. That's exactly what I'm saying. And, of course, the number for H field is always going to be lower. And can you measure it? Of course you can measure it independently. I didn't say you couldn't. I said you can, but the number, if you can measure it, it will always be in the mud by comparison to a antenna. There was one is basically you're going to align a H field detector in the direction of an H field, and that number is going to be micro-miniature in free space. When you do an aerial cross-section and you have the normalized impedance of the antenna and matched, then you'll have the relationship of the antenna, and you'll have a different value of H than you would normally in free space. That's exactly what I'm saying, okay? Can you measure it? Yes, you can. Likely, at a far field, I don't think you're going to have anything with enough near enough sensitivity to do such a thing. You can experiment. You can take your what you think to be a very sensitive H-field detector and try to do it. Get little chunks of ferrite. Cut them to resonant lengths. And you'll see that the H-field dramatically drops off with any kind of distance. It's dramatic. Now, as I said, if you want to increase the sensitivity, short the outside. Complete the path length. But then now you've got a piece of metal around the outside. What are you really measuring? You're measuring near H at that point. Okay, so, you know, the measurement...
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
I hear what you're saying, Glenn, but now I'm going to hit you with specifics. Back in the days when the low frequency requirement was 10 milliwatts per square centimeter, that was one measurement you're going to meet at low frequencies. The second measurement you're going to meet is 192 volts per meter. That's a whopping big signal, 192 volts per meter. The H field was 1/2 ampere per meter. 1/2 ampere per meter. To me, that's a whopping big signal. You keep saying it's going to be so small you can't measure it. Glenn, can I measure 1/2 amp per meter of H field? KC2QIQ, K2LIW.
Oh, you sure can, but you don't want to be standing in it, that's for sure. You know, at that point in time, you know, you're looking at something very, very up close, and you're nearby a radiating, very, very close to a radiating source to get those kinds of levels, Dick.
Glenn, can you tolerate 10 milliwatts per square centimeter? Yes or no?
Measured with an E-field device? Of course.
10 milliwatts per square centimeter in free space is 192 volts per meter, is 1/2 amp per meter. Which one of those three numbers are wrong when they all come together to make exactly 10 milliwatts per square centimeter? 10 milliwatts per square centimeter at a 1 megahertz rate is a very safe number to a human being. What's the problem? K2RIW.
There's no problem. What you have is you've got an antenna and a cross-section, and you're measuring the cross-section, and the V and H are going to have a relationship in the antenna. That number is going to look at the exact H field at that antenna when you're making that measurement of V and have just an H field detector and you were to move in close enough to a source, no E field detection whatsoever, the Hall effect device that you were talking about, and you were 1 amp per meter, you're going to be really close to a very, very high power output, very, very dangerous. K2FW, K66QIQ.
1/2 amp per meter in the far field is a power flux density of 10 milliwatts per square centimeter. Very safe. You're saying 1/2 amp per meter is very unsafe. The 1/2 amp per meter and 192 volts per meter are directly related by 377 ohms in free space. Why is 1/2 amp per meter dangerous when it equals the H field of 10 milliwatts per square centimeter, which equals 192 volts per meter? All three of those numbers hang together. Why should one of the numbers be dangerous and the other two not? What's going on here? KC2QIQ, K2LIW?
Your measurement technique.
I might try to do it with an antenna and relate it back. There is instrumentation that can separately measure E field. There is instrumentation that can separately measure H field. To thoroughly meet C95, you will use three separate pieces of instrumentation at a 1 megahertz rate. If you must confirm 1 megahertz power flux density for radio frequency biohazard, you will make three separate measurements with three separate pieces of instrumentation. The H field measurement is not necessarily an antenna. You're saying that that takes place inside of an antenna with closed loops and something else is going on. Why can't I separately measure 1/2 amp per meter of H field with purely H field sensing devices like a Hall effect device? Where am I going wrong here? 1/2 amp per meter at 1 megahertz is safe as all hell. What makes you think it's not safe? KC2QIQ, K2LAW.
Okay, I've got to stop this conversation because you're just going into a circle here, and there's something that you have to see for your own eyes. Do you have an H field sensor or something that will measure H field?
I had one in my hands in 1970, and if I'm willing to spend a few dollars with DigiKey, I can put one in my hands again, Glenn. Go ahead.
I think that that's something that you're going to have to do before we can even take this conversation one step further. Because really what I want you to do with that H-field sensor, when you finally get one established, go to a frequency that you can adjust it for and get it set up so that you can actually get reliable, repeatable measurements at distance from a source and move it away just like you would an antenna, and you can get a real good feel for what the fall-off is of the H-field from a radiating source, and then we'll pick up this conversation from there. Got to excuse me for now, but I think I'm going to call this one quits for tonight. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
Yeah, I think you're right in that inexpensive DigiKey Hall effect rated at 160 microvolts per Gauss probably has no response way up there at a megahertz. It's probably good to 400 hertz, if you know what I mean. In that respect, that probably is not going to do it. We got into a corner on this one, but have you ever used that C95 report for making confirmation measurements at the low frequency end, where the bathtub-shaped curve of allowable controlled and uncontrolled environment, where you had to confirm the low end? Have you been forced to make those triple measurements at the low frequency, Glenn? KC2QIQ, K2RIW?
Yeah, absolutely, Dick. As a matter of fact, especially with devices like power supplies where they're susceptible generators, you know, you have to meet everything from, you know, anything rated from, you know, 30 megahertz to 1 gigahertz, and conducted measurements from, you know, 150 to 30, 150 kilohertz to 30 megahertz, and also those other radiated fields, very, very important measurements. And I'm very, very familiar with the standards, the specs, and what they do. But as I said, there's one thing I think that right now we're really not on the same page with.